Welcome students this morning from Pius 11th High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. Your instructor can stand too.
All right.
Fine. Please be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they say they're coming, they get the briefs of the case, and sometimes the students do extra activities related to the case. And part of the program is that they meet with a justice after the second oral argument in the morning. The justice will discuss the proceedings of the court and the processes we use, but not the substance and substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to those meetings, which will be about 12:15 in the courtroom. Now, the students have gotten the briefs and synopses. For anyone in the courtroom who would like a synopsis of the case, they are available. The marshal will give them to you, so if you raise your hand, she will take care of that. So let me, if any of the students want anything. Okay, good. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. Justice Wilcox is the justice who will meet with you at after the second oral argument at about 12:15. Next to Justice Wilcox is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the extreme right, far right, is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is 03-2001, Department of Corrections versus David H. Schwartz. Arguing for the Department of Corrections is Robert G. Pultz. Mr. Pultz. Now, this is the hardest question you're going to get today. How do you spell David Schwartz's name?
S-C-H-W-A-R-Z.
Okay, the caption is not quite right. We'll get that changed. Thank you. You may proceed, counsel.
They may be seated.
Heard that argument. We'll go on.
If that's as tough as it gets, I'm...
You're going to be lulled.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Pultz, and it is my privilege to represent the Department of Corrections in the Supreme Court this morning. The department asks the court to do the following: hold that there is only one term of parole or extended supervision on any one underlying sentence, and therefore that the department has jurisdiction to revoke Mr. Dowell's parole. Number two, reverse the Court of Appeals. Number three, order that the decision of the Circuit Court be reinstated, which will have the effect of reinstating the Department of Administration, Division of Hearings and Appeals, decision to revoke Mr. Dowell's parole, as decided at the second revocation hearing held in this case. If there is only one underlying conviction, there is only one period of parole or extended supervision. This has always been the operating principle of the Department of Corrections. We know, justices, that if an offender is released and abides by all the rules of supervision, there will only be this one interrupted time for the offender to continue on parole or extended supervision. Offenders are revoked multiple times, during a period of parole or extended supervision. This raises the question, can we have three or four separate and distinct terms of parole or extended supervision on one underlying sentence?
Mr. Pultz, do you see any difference between parole and extended supervision in regard to the issue before the court?
I don't, Justice Crooks. The difference, as you know, is indeterminate sentence, a parole sentence, the parole board has some discretion to release an individual. But revocation works the same way, and the department's authority over the person on extended supervision is identical. And your resolution of this case will certainly affect both. And
is that why you're here?
Pardon?
Is that why you're here?
Well, we're here to straighten out this question of jurisdiction for both parole and extended supervision. I mean, it certainly applies to both. I'm not sure that I understand the nature of your question.
You should finish in response to Justice Crooks. He asked you, is there any difference between parole and extended supervision?
Other than, again, than the parole board existing, I don't believe that there is. And it's it raises the question, can we have three or four separate terms of parole or extended supervision in the same one underlying conviction? The answer is no. And for authority for that, I would like to direct the court this morning to a couple statutes that have not been discussed in the briefs. The first of those is the Truth in Sentencing Statute, which is found at 973.01, subsection 2. That statute provides that a bifurcated sentence consists of a term of confinement followed by a term of extended supervision. And I am putting emphasis on the words a term. Next, I would direct the court's attention to the extended supervision revocation statute, which is found at section 302.113, subsection 9, subsection AM. That section provides...
Give me that one again.
Certainly. Section 302.113, sub 9, sub AM, which provides a person on extended supervision may go back to prison for all the time remaining on the sentence. And the time remaining on the sentence is the entire sentence less any time spent confined prior to release to extended supervision and all time spent confined on previous revocations, plural.
Well, why should we look at those? Does this case involve extended supervision?
No, it doesn't. It involves parole. But the statute that we're looking at, 304.072 sub 3, says that it concerns persons on probation, parole, and extended supervision.
Well, you might have different rules for probation, parole, and extended supervision. That is, for parole under the old statute, it might be differently interpreted than extended supervision under the new statute. It's possible.
I don't. I think that there may be different rules in terms of what the department considers to be the rules of supervision, but when you look at the statute in question here, 304.072, subsection 3, I don't think you're going to be able to interpret that one way for parole and another way for extended supervision. At least I haven't been able to figure out a methodology of doing that.
That's why I asked you, why is the department here? This man is how old?
Uh, I believe he's in his early 30s. I'm not certain.
Okay. And he's got an 80-year sentence?
Correct.
And when he reaches his mandatory release, he's going to be 84 or 80 in his 80s? And you're coming in here because you wanted to give him two more years, two plus years?
Correct.
Why?
Because the disposition of this case will decide many other cases, Chief Justice Abrahamson, and you're going to fashion a rule that's going to affect people on supervision that do not get convicted of new crimes, or if they do get convicted, get sentenced to much less than 80 years in prison.
Not only people under the old system, but people under Truth in Sentencing, too.
Correct. For instance, and I think, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think a very good example of what you're talking about, how I can illustrate this, is the fact, and it's been brought up in the briefs, that we have this 80-year sentence for Mr. Dowell. What wasn't mentioned in the briefs is the fact that the circuit court judge down in Milwaukee who imposed that sentence imposed that as a consecutive sentence to any other sentence that he would have been serving, which means his parole, his revocation of parole. So the person, what we have here is the person in our criminal justice system who we say knows the most about the defendant, the gravity of the crime, the impact on the victim, aggravation, mitigating circumstances. That person said 80 years for Mr. Dowell, and the other case isn't de minimis, so you're going to serve that time first.
Counsel, are you finished?
I am.
Okay. It causes me to pause because I know in a vernacular that parole is like extended supervision. You know, I mean, I hear that. But that kind of generalization is different for me than saying how and analyzing how does this case affect the Truth in Sentencing statutory scheme with regard to extended supervision. So I would go to, as you suggest, the 973012, and I'd probably look at a number of statutes with regard to Truth in Sentencing if that were the issue before me. But I didn't prepare, and I don't think either of you cite, 973 said new statutes. And so I'm leery of this. It's one thing to be generically saying, well, you know, they're essentially the same. But it's another to say how that the facts of this parole case interact with the extended supervision statutes under Truth in Sentencing. And so tell me if I should be leery, if I'm just being overly cautious, or if that's a different analysis and that maybe we need, if that's what you're pursuing, then we need to have more briefs or something. Just respond, because I'm a little leery.
Well, I don't think you're being overly cautious, but my point is that under Mr. Dowell's theory, we can have three or four or however many separate and distinct periods of extended supervision or parole. But if we look at the statutes that I've cited this morning, 973.01, subsection 2, that says a term of extended supervision. And then you go back and to the extended supervision revocation statute, 302.113, subsection 9, subsection AM, and that says that It recognizes that there can be multiple revocations on that one term. You go to 304.072 sub 3 and you note that that statute includes both extended supervision and parole. Have I answered the question?
You've answered the question. I still have a little hesitation, but
it makes me uneasy because we're dealing with something you haven't briefed. It seems to me if we go that way, we have to go through and look at all the TIS because to see what else is affected by that. And that this is a parole situation, as I understand it, under the old law. So I recognize that the statute includes parole, probation, and extended supervision, but it is possible that it might have different meanings for each of the three because you have three different types of supervision by the Department of Corrections that come under different statutes that arise under different circumstances. So if you're going to hang your hat on that, you ought to tell us now, and then we have to think about that. Or can you go with your briefs and your arguments relating to the statutes that deal with not truth in sentencing? I'm just pushing Justice Bradley's question.
I think it's probably a stretch to say that the department wants to hang its hat on these two statutes. However, when I looked at those in preparing for oral argument, I found those to be very persuasive as to what the legislature wanted to do with extended supervision. And then realizing that the statute and the rule that we're talking about is going to cover parole and extended supervision, I thought that it was prudent to bring it to the court's attention. We have, as you know, as we've outlined in the brief, we have several arguments that don't involve the TIS statutes.
Right, and that's good, and I think it's important that you do bring it to the court because the court's well aware that that statute covers all three. Now, there's something you said initially that interested me, too, and then you said, in this case, we have a conviction for a new crime. But you could have cases where you don't have a conviction, but it looks like the person has committed a crime and that would be grounds for revocation, even if you don't have a conviction, right?
That's correct.
Right. So here, 5 years, and I think it's 5 years, after this period of parole, it is discovered that he at least is alleged to have committed and then ultimately convicted of a sexual assault, right? But it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years, could have been 8 years here, maybe not eight, but at least seven of that. And then you could have extended his time in prison by what kind of proof do you have to bring in on a parole verification? Preponderance of the evidence?
On a parole revocation? It's by a preponderance.
So by a preponderance of evidence, you could put him back in prison for something he did in 97. Right?
Correct. Let me...
And the older you get, that is, the more time that passes, it's harder for the department to prove it, but it's harder also to make a defense. Right? I mean, stale claims are troublesome.
Well, that's the reason that there is a due process revocation hearing, and the offender at those hearings is represented by, generally by, a public defender, very able legal counsel, and can raise all those issues. Those decisions are subject to judicial review by certiorari, and so there are checks and balances. I don't criticize the court for being troubled by that aspect of it. If I could provide a different example, however, offender A gets out on supervision and commits a sexual assault. He has 10 years of parole. The violation is unknown. On the day before he's subject to discharge, the DNA databank matches him, like was done in this case. Now, there was no intervening misconduct or return to prison, so the department could revoke him, and that whole 10 years is subject to forfeiture. Somebody in Mr. Dowell's, and there's no dispute about that, the criminal justice system has never questioned that. He gets a due process hearing. Somebody in Mr. Dowell's position does the same thing, has this intervening misconduct, goes back for a little while. We find out at the end of his 10-year parole period that he committed the sexual assault, but he cannot be revoked. He gets, in essence, a benefit for intervening misconduct. I don't believe that that is what the legislature intended the result to be.
Counsel, your argument is only made for those folks who haven't completed the term of parole. So if they have a 10-year parole period in your example, and you learn about the commission of a crime during that 10-year period in the 11th year, you're not arguing that we ought to then go back into that period, or are you?
No, I am not.
Okay, so it has to be, well, the term of parole is still in existence.
I think you have it exactly right, Justice Rogan-Sack. And that, the Department's position is that is the purpose of Section 304.072, subsection 3, that when that final discharge from sentence comes along, that you're done, and the Department, even if it learns a day after that discharge of misconduct, cannot do anything about it. If the Department learns about misconduct the day before the discharge and issues an apprehension request or takes one of the three actions prescribed in the statute, then the Department preserves jurisdiction. That's what the statute says, and the revocation can be initiated and completed outside of the
Mr. Pulse, I want to ask you about that and follow up on Justice Rogan's question, because I know we're trying to interpret sub 3 of 304.072, and specifically that term of supervision. What does that mean? Neither of you have cited to the very next sentence in that statute under sub 4. The sentence of a revoked parolee or person on extended supervision resumes running on the day he or she is received at the correctional institution, and so on. Resumes running. It seems right within the body of this statute. The legislature has carved out a distinction between the sentence and the term of supervision. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing something, but that's a credit statute. And it just says that now you're going to be given credit, not from the date of the violation, but the date that you re-enter the prison.
But that's not what the statute says. The statute says the sentence resumes running. And then sub 5 is the credit statute. The sentence of a revoked probationer shall be credited with the period of custody in jail. So you've got two separate sections of 304.072 that talk about the sentence and when it starts again. And then you've got sub 3 that talks about the term of supervision. It seems right within the body of 304.072, the legislature has discerned a distinction between the two.
Well, I think that's because if you look at the legislative history that I've outlined, that the time on parole does not vest until the end of the sentence. So in sub 4, they're talking about revocation, and your sentence technically is running when you're out on supervision, but the time is invested. You're not going to get credit for that time unless you're not engaging in misconduct. And then at the very last day, all that time vest, you did your 10-year sentence, but you just did part of it on the street. So what you're talking about there is the time, the sentence starts running in terms of that time cannot be taken away. That time is vested and will continue to vest until you're released again to parole or extended supervision.
Could I ask you, sir, Wisconsin Act 528 seems to be the source of this legislation that we're trying to interpret. Can you talk about the legislative history of that act?
Yes.
Where did it come from?
Where did the legislative history come from? Where did I do my research?
No. Basically, was this act basically drafted by, I don't remember whether it was the Department of Corrections or the Division of Corrections?
I don't know that. It wasn't clear from the, and it's been some time, so I can't give you an answer to that. I don't know who was the sponsor of the bill. I do know that there was the Cox decision that I talk about in the brief had come down from the courts, and this was an effort to codify the Cox decision and say, yes, this is a good idea, this is what we're going to do. If the violation becomes apparent while you're on probation, parole, or extended supervision, we're going to say that one of those three actions preserves, and even if you hit that expiration date from the sentence, that the department still has jurisdiction over the person. So it really is an effort to reach out and grab jurisdiction for a longer period of time when the violation is discovered within the term or the period of supervision.
Could you speak about the standard of review, deference?
That's one point that I agree with the Court of Appeals on. They applied a de novo standard of review and did so because the respondent, David Schwartz, in this particular case, had ruled, at least I think this was part of the reasoning, they say so in the decision, had ruled inconsistently on this issue in the past. And so, you know, at various times there was some different thinking in that agency, which is within the Department of Administration, separate from the Department of Corrections. They have viewed this two ways over the years. So it should be de novo, and it's a question of law. And so I think we're
Did you say the department? Did you say the Division of Hearing and Appeals, or the Department of Corrections has viewed it differently?
The Division of Hearings and Appeals, which is in the Department of Administration, has viewed it differently from time to time.
What about the Department of Corrections?
Well, I can only speak for my tenure with the Department of Corrections, which goes back some period of time. In fact, I was a probation and parole officer for many years before I became an attorney and during the time that I attended law school. And I know that this is just the general way that people in the department have looked at this according to my institutional knowledge. I want to thank the court.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant State Public Defender Michael Gould, representing James Dowell.
Good morning. I am Michael Gould, and I represent the respondent, James Dowell. It's our contention that by its plain meaning, Section 304.073 sub 3 limits actions on violations of the rule, violations of rules of supervision to the term of probation, parole, or extended supervision in which that violation occurs. And there can be separate terms that we're dealing with here. If the legislator had intended to extend this to the entire length of the sentence, they could have used language that would clearly state that the person is subject to revocation during the entire length of the sentence. But it doesn't say that.
If we're talking about the intent of the legislature, why would the legislature ever want to give someone a pass for committing a crime just because they didn't learn about it until a later period of time?
Well,
what policy is served by that?
Okay. Well, over a certain period of time, there's an interest in finality. We have statutes of limitation which limit prosecutions for misdemeanors, for example, to 3 years. If the violation is undiscovered for more than 3 years.
No, but we're not talking about a statute of limitations here.
But the important thing I would argue to think about is the underlying purpose for which the person is on probation, parole, or extended supervision. And that is to permit a person which we have deemed, that the courts have deemed to be eligible for probation, parole, or extended supervision, supervised release within the community for a period of time. And so it's not like, and we have to think about the thing that we're talking about here, this crime, and it was a horrible crime, no question about it. But it was also a rule violation. And it was, and in the context that we're thinking about it here, it's nothing more than a rule violation. So when he committed the horrible crime, he did two things. He committed a bad crime for which he was subject and was prosecuted, and he violated the rules. But once the person's term of supervision, be it probation, parole, or extended supervision, is revoked, then there's no further need to consider rule violations because he's done. It's the time is over with. He's back in prison. If he's subsequently re-released, there's an interest in finality for that person to start with a clean slate. And most violations of probation and parole are far, far less serious than the one we're talking about in this case. So when the person is re-released, it doesn't serve any purpose to revoke that person for a violation which happened during a previous term of supervision. If that violation, undiscovered, was a serious violation of the criminal law, he can be revoked.
Doesn't it promote the policy of parole or extended supervision, which is the person that is out on either provision is to follow all the rules of law? Doesn't it promote that policy if you don't give him a pass?
You could argue that, but I don't think that's what the statute intends. And I think that to permit revocation for violations that occurred during previous terms is contrary to the goals of revocation and contrary to the wording of the statute. I mean, we're only talking about rule violations here. We're not talking about crimes.
I understand that, but the rule, one of the rules is, and the rule we're talking about here, is that you have to follow all the laws of the state, correct?
And, absolutely.
And he didn't follow it. And so the two policies that I see is the one that results in revocation is if you don't follow the rules, you're subject to revocation, and you're telling me the policy of finality, well, you didn't catch him this time, so you can't use it the next time he's out on parole. I have a hard time understanding why the legislature would want to do that.
Because it's for the same reason that they would specify any kind of endpoint on any kind of jurisdictional thing for a violation or a crime. At a certain point, we want to allow finality and allow the person to start fresh.
But according to opposing counsel, if they didn't learn about this sexual assault until he had completed his parole, so at some point in time he's completed it, he's discharged from that sentence, then they couldn't use it. So there is finality there. It's just not as early as you would like to have it.
That's correct. So the overarching point that I'm making that is that considering these rule violations, the DOC is acting and supervising the person sort of in loco parentis, as a kind of parent. And it just doesn't make sense to revoke someone for something that happened earlier. And then as he pointed out, this hasn't an effect on a wide variety of things. There's nothing, if you construe the statute this way, that's going to limit this to undiscovered violations. It could be for any violation. This is going to give an enormous amount of power to probation and parole agents. And a person who's committed a violation, maybe even a misdemeanor during the previous term, it could be beyond the statute of limitations for the misdemeanor, and then he could be out, he could be doing everything he's supposed to be doing, he could have a job, he could have, you know, be doing quite well, and then all of a sudden he could be subject to revocation for something that's happened in the fairly distant past, and even though there may be some procedural safeguards in terms of the administrative law judge making a decision.
But wouldn't he be subject to revocation for his own behavior?
Excuse me?
Wouldn't he be subject to revocation for his own behavior? We're talking about his behavior and whether he followed the rules. And so when we're looking and focusing in on his behavior, you argued before that it didn't make sense to look back, but do we want to have a rule that says that because, for whatever reason, your violation wasn't discovered, but now we find it, we have to ignore it?
Well, because the statute specifies an endpoint for the jurisdiction over it, at a certain point, yes, you're going to have to overlook it. But the rule that they're asking for doesn't just limit it to undiscovered violations. You could even have a situation where, for example, there was a discovered violation. The person was revoked for that violation, but sent to prison for a shorter amount of time than the agent felt was appropriate. Let's say the agent was asking for a 4-year reconfinement and they only got 1 year. There's nothing, if you interpret the statute the way that the department is asking for, to prevent that agent from asking that the person be reconfined and hopefully get another more sympathetic ALJ to think, oh, this violation was really bad. To fashion a rule that way is going to encourage second guessing by the Department of Correction on discovered violations. It's also going to encourage, I would argue, bureaucratic sloth. Maybe the reason the violation wasn't discovered was because of lack of diligence on the part of the probation agent. And there's also nothing that's going to prohibit revisiting these prior rule violations, which may be quite minor. All of that is going to undermine the purpose of rehabilitation for which the subsequent term of parole or extended supervision is supposed to foster.
One of the reasons why this case is important because of the evolution of technology and the fact that because of the DNA samples that are required with convictions of felonies, that we can now go back and look and do DNA matches. Isn't that why this case is important?
Well, that's one reason why this case is important. But in this case, even with the denial of revocation, the system worked because he was prosecuted and he was punished for the crime that he committed. And that's the point. For serious rule violations that happened in the past, which also happen to be crimes, the criminal law is there to make sure that that person is accountable for their behavior.
What if the statute of limitations had run out on the offense?
Well, then I would argue, usually for very serious crimes, the statute of limitation is quite lengthy. So if it's run out, I'm guessing you're not going to have too many cases where the statute of limitation on a serious crime is going to have run out and he's still going to be on parole. So, I mean, you might be able to fashion a hypothetical that would encompass that, but I think that would be pretty unlikely. Misdemeanors, the statute is 3 years, and then there's varying statutes depending on the seriousness of the offense. And, of course, if it's a homicide, there is no statute of limitations for homicide.
Did you have a question, John?
No, I think Justice Butler, because my question was in the same vein as Justice Butler. We hear a lot about DNA. This is a DNA case. DNA works both ways. It convicts people and it allows people that perhaps were unjustly convicted to be released. And from the standpoint of the argument here, it would seem to me that we could write this case to take care of some of your concerns for the, quote, violations you're talking about, the where the agent themselves found a violation. I'm talking about the rules. But this is clearly a serious violation. And would you have any objection that if we said, yes, you're right, as far as the type of violation you're arguing, the hypothetical, but in this case, it would be appropriate?
I would argue that that's not appropriate, because then you would be making a series of policy decisions limiting the impact of the decision when those are the kinds of things that really, because there are a wide variety of situations that would come up under the DOC's interpretation, and I think those are the kinds of things that the legislature should be deciding.
Is this statute ambiguous or not?
It's our position that the statute is not ambiguous at all.
That
term of supervision does not, obviously, in an abstract way, when a person is in prison, he's being supervised. But that's not what's meant. Supervision is the time when the person is on parole, on probation, or on extended supervision.
So you can have several terms of supervision, as happened here, for one crime.
For one crime.
Does the legislative history help?
I don't think the legislative history really gives, at least as far as what I've read in the petitioner's briefs, and I admit that I did not delve deeply into the legislative history because what I saw that was produced was not conclusive. I don't think it really tells us anything. I frankly don't think that when this statute was written, they conceived of this situation.
No, I want to follow up on this point. Chief raised the point of ambiguity. Here the Court of Appeals inserted a word, current, which is not in the statute, and the state's argument is, well, look, if you're inserting that, then there must be ambiguity.
I would argue that they did not insert the word current. I would say that they just used the word current in applying the statute to distinguish between the parole, term of parole, which began when he was released the second time in 2001, from the previous term, which ended when he was revoked in 1997. I would argue that what the department wants is for this court to insert language which is borrowed from Section 302.11 into this statute. They would like the court to insert the term, until the end of the sentence. That
discharge.
Language is not there.
Until end of sentence or discharge.
Or discharge. I mean, that's language that the legislature could have used and did not use.
What about, is it possible the statute can be interpreted differently for probation, parole, and extended supervision?
Well, the statute clearly mentions both probation, parole, and extended supervision. I share your concern and Justice Bradley's concern with, I'm not sure how this parole case works with extended supervision, and I haven't had a chance to see the statutes that were referenced by counsel for the department. So I can't give you an answer to that question without having looked at those statutes.
Can you have extended supervision again where you're put back in prison, then get out again under extended supervision?
I think that's certainly possible with especially with some sexual assault cases, we're seeing very, very lengthy terms of extended supervision. So it's possible that a person could be put back for multiple times on extended supervision. That's easily possible.
Your interpretation, in effect, puts a statute of limitations on a rule violation.
That's absolutely right.
What you do is you say either get that within that short or long, depending on what it is, time period, or the department is out.
That's correct.
You get all the rule violations that you want as long as the guy's on parole. Once you put him back in, that period of parole is finished. And that anything that the person did in that time period is irrelevant. It's been revoked. He's back in. Now you start, in terms of parole and parole violation, fresh the next time he gets out.
That's absolutely correct.
That's what the result of your interpretation is.
Precisely.
But this has been raised here. the sense of that, it concerns me that so undiscovered crimes, they get a pass. I mean, that's really what
happens. Get a pass on, yeah.
And particularly, as Justice Butler raised, in DNA, when you have these matches, it just seems inconsistent with the policy of the legislature.
Well, no, because they are still subject to criminal prosecution for the crimes that they've committed. And if DNA evidence is going to be involved, we're going to be talking about a serious crime. And so they're going to be subject to prosecution and will be held accountable for that crime.
Their parole has already been revoked, right? The problem is that there's no knowledge of that serious crime, and they may have kept him in longer for a serious crime.
That's correct.
Okay.
I concede that had they known about this violation when they think he would have been revoked for the entire amount of time, including the 2 years that's remaining.
Which would have been, and they could have convicted him of the crime also, but they don't have to because they can keep him in. And if he had a long prison term, you don't have to go through a trial for beyond a reasonable doubt. You can just put it into the original crime because of a rule violation.
Because of a rule. That's correct.
Now, I found persuasive Mr. Pulse's argument that a guy that gets a series of paroles, keeps going in and out, gets a better deal than a guy who has a long-term parole. Because you have a statute of limitations that you're imposing for this guy who goes in for a year, out for a year, in for a year, et cetera. Whereas if he's got a 10-year parole term or extended supervision term, if he violated the rule in year one, they can get him in year 10, right?
That's correct.
How's that fair, and how does that affect public policy?
Well, there's going to be a lot of interpreting the statute as written is, of course, going to raise some concerns. And, you know, and you can fashion a hypothetical that it's going to make either interpretation look bad. But I think that if we look at it from the way that it was intended or to be written, that's something that if that's a significant problem and concern, that the legislature can always amend the statute to fix whatever problems they had with the original drafting.
Has the Department of Corrections gone in for a repair of the statute? Do you know?
I have no idea. I doubt if they would do that until the disposition of this case.
When there's discussion about, you said you can concoct hypotheticals one way or the other. What comes to my mind is this kind of a hypothetical, and the students here would be involved in this. That is, they're 16 years of age, and they've been acting up a little bit, and if we sit in loco parentis, as you suggest, they've been acting up a little bit, and so their parents say, okay, for 4 weeks, you can't drive. And let's say that the student, on a Thursday night in the third week, snuck out with the car, went for a ride, came back, parents didn't know about it, finished off the 4 weeks, then got the keys back to be able to drive. 2 years later, age 18, kid's acting up again. So the parents say, okay, listen, to encourage good behavior, that's the underlying policy here to kind of manipulate behavior, again, we're going to take your car keys away because you've been hanging around with the wrong kids and you've been doing some bad and naughty things. So car keys, and you can't drive for a month. And let's say this time the student wises up and doesn't drive for a month. And about the 28th day, the parents learned that 2 years ago, during that period, the third week of a Thursday, there had been driving.
And I think of, now I'm not talking about the interpreting the statute, but what makes sense. Does it make sense for those parents to say, you're not going to get the keys back because we found out 2 years ago when you were on another supervision that you violated the rule? Is that kind of a hypothetical consistent? Does it hit what your argument is, or is it not quite work with your argument?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't punish my 7-year-old for something she did when she was a 3-year-old. There's been enough of an intervening lapse between the two between the first violation and then the second period of supervision where, you know, the parent would say, I'm really disappointed to find out that the last time you did this, that you violated the rule, but you've been good this time, so you're going to get a pass on that. Jurisdictional statutes which prescribe an endpoint, be they statutes of limitation or this statute, sometimes mean people do get a pass on their violations of the rule. And that's all we're talking about is rule violations. We're not talking about crime because that's a separate issue. And so that's a perfect hypothetical. And it illustrates why the interpretation that we're arguing for makes sense. There's a rational reason to have this scheme. It's simple. It's easy to administer. Otherwise, every single person that's on a subsequent term of parole or extended supervision, not only do they have to focus on not screwing up this time, they have to worry about some violation which occurred in the past. And they're subject to arbitrary behavior on the part of the agent, where we don't want the agent going back there. We want the agent supervising them for what they're doing right now, not in the past. If they committed a crime, then the criminal law can step in and take care of the problem.
That's really your response, because the real problem here is that if you revoke probation and then let them out, if there's been something really serious during that first parole term, you have somebody very dangerous out on the street. And that is against public policy.
And as it happened in this case, he was arrested and prosecuted. His parole ended when the crime was discovered and he was arrested.
And if there's a statute of limitations issue, then that's just true whether the guy's out on parole or not. You can't get him.
That's correct.
And he's still dangerous and out there, but the law has determined finality.
Well, if the statute has run out on the crime, then presumably the crime wasn't so serious. Serious guys that are really dangerous, and there's no doubt that Mr. Dowell is a very dangerous man. I'm not arguing that. But for guys, we find out that he was dangerous, we have criminal laws to take care of that problem.
Could you speak to the standard of review and whether any deference is owed to anyone here?
There's no argument between the parties on the standard of review. It's de novo. This is a question of statutory interpretation. There's no definitive history in the record of what the practice was. It's just a pure question of statutory interpretation.
Whose practice are we interested in, the Department of Corrections or the Administrative Law Judge or the Division of Appeals and Hearing?
Well, if there was enough material in the record, there might be some issue there. But there may have been one case where they came out the other way. But the record of that is pretty fuzzy, so I would... it's de novo review.
That's
There's
what
no
the Court of Appeals said, and it said the record was fuzzy at all these levels, if I understood that footnote.
And they were right.
Suppose it could be shown that the legislation that we were talking about was written by the Department of Corrections, or perhaps then the Division of Corrections. Should we pay any attention to that?
To be honest, Justice Prosser, I did not, so I can't give you a
I'm just giving you a hypothetical. Suppose it could be shown.
I would still say no, and this is the problem with legislative history, because that – are we determining the intent of the legislature, the intent of the people contributing to the drafter? That's why it's using legislative history is a very problematic tool for figuring out what a statute means. I mean, sometimes, in some cases, that may be all that you have, but I don't think that what we do have here enables us to do that.
Well, why can't you argue the Department of Corrections would want to have more control over the parolee and therefore would draft something that would cover the whole period? Well, I suppose you could argue Department of Corrections wants to have statute of limitations so that their agents can pay attention to the most recent issues, not the old ones, and not have arbitrary and capricious. I suppose you could argue it both ways. Maybe.
You could argue it both ways, and I...
You just don't want to argue it either way.
No, because it's our position that the statute is clear and that we don't even need to go there. Well, if there are no further questions.
Sorry. My time is any further expired. Questions? Thank you, counsel. Oh, I do have one. I'm sorry. Is there anything about the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals that you would change if you were writing the opinion for this court?
I think there were a few typographical errors referring to the statutes, but that beyond that, no.
I think we can handle that.
The name.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pulse.
Thank you. I wanted to join the discussion concerning Justice Prosser's question about what would we make of this if we found that the revision of 304.072 subsection 3 was initiated by the Department of Corrections, and I would add by any criminal justice agency. I wouldn't include the Public Defender's Office in there, although they're considered a criminal justice agency. But it is hard to imagine that the Department of Corrections or a law enforcement entity would come forward and say, we're going to create this loophole for offenders. And although it's possible to argue, as Chief Justice Abrahamson did, that the department could have been thinking, well, we want agents to concentrate on just what's happening in the present released period on supervision. I did go over the legislative history thoroughly, and there's no indication of that within the legislative history.
Mr. Pulse, with all due respect, how can you tell what the history means simply by who drafted it? Don't you need more?
Well, I think you do need more, but I mean, I think Justice Prosser's point is a good one if I'm picking up on where he's going with that. I'm not saying that it's definitive. I'm not saying that.
A number of reasons why they might want to change a particular statute. I don't think you can infer what the reason is just by who did it. I think you have to look beyond that, don't you?
No, and I agree with that. And that's, I'm not going quite that far. The other point that I wanted to address is this business of revoking people a second time for the same violation or revoking somebody for a known violation during the second term. Well, in the reply brief, I address this, and there is case law, the Locklear case, that says that the department is obligated to move forward within a reasonable period of time. Certainly, if the agent is aware of a violation and is initiating revocation and doesn't do it on those grounds and take time for that or request that time be taken, that would seem to dispose of that particular violation. And I would agree it would be unfair to do so. And, you know, despite some of the bad press we get over at the Department of Corrections, I will assure you that, you know, agents, I can vouch for each and every one of them, look at these things carefully and fairly, and are guided by, hopefully, legal counsel when they have a question like, well, you know, can we go back? We knew about this particular violation. So, you know, and then we have this system of checks and balances. You know, it just isn't an agent's decision. An agent goes to the supervisor, and the supervisor and the agent consider various alternatives to supervision and what the possibilities are. So one of the problems with the Court of Appeals decision is that the department often initiates alternatives to revocation. Under the Court of Appeals decision, if there's an undiscovered violation, the department is not going to be able to address it if there was an intervening conduct, intervening revocation. And the department does things like orders community service, orders treatment programs, orders an electronic monitoring bracelet be put on a person for a length of time, orders no contact provisions. So there's this whole variety of tools in the agent's arsenal that they can pull out. But what the Court of Appeals is saying, you can't even talk to that offender about that violation. And then I would go back to Justice Rogensack's point about the public policy implications. That does not promote public policy. And the policies behind supervision are, number one, accountability. Number two, public protection. And number three, an offender's rehabilitation. The public is not protected when violations are not addressed. The offender is not rehabilitated when he can escape consequences for misconduct during his supervision. And accountability certainly is out of the window when we have this period of amnesty, as I have referred to in the brief. I see that my time is up, and I thank the Court for their time and consideration of this case.
Thank you, Mr. Pultz. Thank you, Mr. Gould, for your arguments today on what the term of supervision means in these statutes. That concludes our hearing on 03-2001, Department of Corrections versus David Schwartz. And the court will take a few moments in recess so students may leave if they wish to, and our other group of students may come in.